at Oklahoma State University and a PhD from University of Nebraska, all of those in agronomy. Along with Marv Stone and John Solly, Bill is recognized for developing the GreenSeeker NDVI sensor, which is used for predicting grain yields and making fertilizer nitrogen rate recommendations. His recent work with Randy Taylor led to the development of the OSU hand planter for maize producers in the developing world. Bill is currently a current editor of Agronomy Journal. He has advised 77 graduate students that have completed their degrees, 26 PhD students, and 51 master's students. He has lived and worked in Mexico and Guatemala with CIMMYT, and is the author of 198 peer-reviewed publications, 2 books, and 11 patents. With that, Josh McGrath's going to provide a few extra words.
Thanks, Carrie. It really is a pleasure to introduce Dr. Ron. I am at the University of Kentucky now. I'm from Delaware, did my PhD at the University of Delaware. And some of the greatest professional compliments I've ever received is people that assumed I was at Oklahoma State and somehow associated with Bill because I sing his praises so often. And it really is, I mean that, one of the biggest. I met Bill in May of 2007 by accident, purely by accident, when I was visiting a friend in Oklahoma. I was a phosphorus guy back when we had phosphorus guys and nitrogen guys. My advisor was Tom Sims, so I was a phosphorus guy for sure. And Bill sucked me into doing some nitrogen work, and it's really a great, great honor. This guy is really a model for me of how he's worked across disciplines with engineers, very broadly, and I think that's something that we can all kind of look to as an example of how to solve problems creatively working across very different disciplines. So with that, it's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Bill Ron, and come see Carrie and I after the seminar for drink tickets. Thank you.
Thanks, Josh. Thanks to Josh and Carrie. They selected the person to give the presentation, and I'm most appreciative. Also, Kyle Freeman, Mosaic, that have funded the reception that's taking place immediately afterwards. So thank you, Carrie, Josh, and Kyle. There's a picture that I put on the screen. I found it of Dr. Haft and Dr. Walsh that was taken a few years back, but I know that Bob worked very hard to get this started and set up, and a lot of time and energy that was spent there, and so thank you also to Dr. Haft. I was curious, I wanted to kind of cover a little bit about Dr. Walsh and in his career. With Malcolm Sumner and Dr. Keeney, reducing arsenic toxicity, other work with Keith Kelling, also with Dr. Keeney on the Bayou sewage sludge, a lot of these things were published in JEQ. And then in addition to that, work on atmospheric sulfur deposition, sulfur deficient alfalfa plants, and a lot of work associated with N and S that I think tied into some earlier work from Gene Camprath at North Carolina State. It's fun for me to be included in this list. I talked to Bill Pan this morning and have seen Dr. Sheppers. A lot of really fun people. I know that probably half of you are wondering why you weren't selected to talk. And still wondering who it is that I am. But these people are well recognized, and it's fun to be included on that list. So I start with clearly mentors that we all have that are out there. I had unique circumstance in terms of where I grew up. I did grow up in Mexico and Colombia. During the summers, I spent the time on the family farm in Nebraska, but I did know Dr. Borlaug when I was just a kid. He always, when he'd run into me after I'd been educated, called me the second generation. I was one of those RF kids, and very few of those Rockefeller Foundation kids actually went into agriculture. I think Frank Stoniker at Colorado State is one of those. If you can, the book by Noel Vietmeyer, Our Daily Bread, really covers Dr. Borlaug's life in a fashion that is, I don't know, his commitment and energy kind of stands out and above. And I list Mother Teresa simply because I have three girls and always kind of set these things, and this is the back screen on my computer, that we all have to have examples. We have some incredible examples that are there. One last thing with Dr. Borlaug was that no sooner had he received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1971 that he was the ambassador for agriculture. And he did that until the day he died, and did so incredibly admirably, that so many people do not know how difficult that was, but he took on that task and delivered. My major professor at Nebraska was Professor Robert Olson, and when I arrived at Nebraska, I just received a master's degree from Oklahoma State and thought that I knew a few things. But Prophet asked me to analyze some data from some long-term stuff on phosphorus that he had at Mead and I think another one at Concord. So I kind of wanted to impress Prophet that I thought I knew a few things. And I analyzed the data, and back then it was a little different. We were using cards and card readers, and it was an arduous task. And I think I was probably some of that last generation that was feeding cards in with every single card was a line of data. It just took a lot of time. Anyway, I had generated, I don't know, a stack this high of different analysis. I had regression of all kinds, SAS, stepwise, forward, backwards, and if there'd have been a sideways option, I'd have done that too. But I took this stack of paper in there. I had partitioned every single degree of freedom into within an inch of its numeric life, and put the stack of paper on Prof's office and told him that I had completed the analysis. And I went back to my office, and within, I don't know, 10, maybe 15 minutes, but probably 10, Prof shows up with the stack of paper, and he put it on my desk, and he said, "You know, Bill, this is really nice, but," he says, could I get some treatment means?" And I knew a lot about analyzing data, but I knew absolutely nothing about synthesis and interpretation. And Prof gave me a lesson that day I'll never forget. So I'm here because of a lot of graduate students, and I thought about that where this is outside my office. But the students have made this possible. I've supervised, yes, but the students have done a lot of work, and I think those numbers are updated. I think I have 6 graduating this semester, and it's been a horsepower that's out there that's been obviously significant, that they're the ones that do the work. PhD graduates that stand out, that are out there in the world, Robert Mullen, I think, is here, Dr. Freeman as well. But so many students that, as you look back on it, that because of the horsepower that we had, both at the PhD level and at the master's level, I think a lot should have been expected. I think that We have had robust funding, robust facilities, whether it's experiment station, tractors, combines, you name it, is that in the U.S., especially a lot of the fertility guys in every single state, we do have funding to do really whatever it is that we want. And I think that all of us have to deliver. So for me, many things that you'll see, you've seen before, especially if I've talked, but I didn't know what else to do. With the 80 students, I could have had 80 slides just of, 160 slides, maybe two slides a student for the number of students that have graduated. But I've, for those that I didn't pick your work that I'm going to cover, I apologize. Bill Pan, he went through a flurry of slides last year, and that was great fun, but what a lot of work. So I've tried to kind of focus, and it's a journey, it's a puzzle. But I do think that we at OSU have been able, and I'll describe why, we've been able to ask the right questions in the right order and always to deliver a product. So long-term experiments have been a huge part of what we do. There's no way that we could have generated what many of the things I'm going to report on tonight had we not had those long-term experiments. That the oldest, the 125th harvest, will be in June of this coming year. Dr. Westerman, Dr. Arnall, who are here, Billy Tucker in the middle, designed a lot of those trials that went out. The Magruder plots are obviously not replicated. They were implemented at a time prior to the advent of modern statistics, but they do remain relevant today. The check plot that's not received any nitrogen fertilizer for 125 years, our soil microbiologist found cyanobacteria and azotobacter as well. And so how is it that we produce 20 bushels per acre every year on a plot that hasn't received any nitrogen for 125 years? Some of these things had come out, that there were cyanos that were present. But they do remain relevant today. And again, one of the reasons on long-term trials why I think that we've shared some success. This is experiment 502, which is near La Homa, Oklahoma. Dr. Arnall took this picture for us that, you can see those boundaries literally to the very edge that are out there. This is basically an NPK trial that easily can be used and detected. But the curious thing is that the response to fertilizer nitrogen and the responses that are seen within that field change every year. So one of the things in terms of nitrogen that I have been lucky to do, and I think I kind of learned that from Prof, was that if you're going to stay in research, you need to focus. And that whatever that focus is going to be, that you need to stay in that realm and do as good a job as absolutely possible. And what I mean by that is that it's so easy, especially today, to get distracted into this realm or that realm or different products. There's just so many things that a person could be drawn into. But we have focused on nitrogen and pretty much nitrogen only. One of the things that we do is that we require our students to become nitrogen cycle ninjas. And it's an exercise, and it's kind of catchy. And believe me, when they show up at the meetings, if they're ninjas, they all pull out their cards and want to show them to make sure that I hadn't taken it away. And to earn their cards, they have to basically reproduce every single component that's on this graph. We want them not only to be able to reproduce it, but we want them to be able to understand it and to have an in-depth understanding of each and every one of those components. So One of the things, again, that I talked or that I mentioned briefly is that I think that we have asked the right questions. As a function of time, I think we've been given that luxury to have 10, 15, 20, 30 minutes a day to think about what it was that we were doing. And that I would also encourage younger faculty to spend some time just thinking out, drawing out, and plotting. But nitrogen use efficiency for cereal grain production, what was it in the world? It's a question that we asked, and it's a question that we answered. This paper, among others, has been obviously heavily cited, and all it is a review paper. And so that one, as editor of Agronomy Journal, anybody wants to submit a review paper, we desperately seek those, because review papers represent a robust treatment of whatever that topic is. And those papers then are heavily cited. And then that increases our impact factor, so all is good. But that, could I recruit review papers? I would desperately like to do that today. Another one on nitrogen in terms of NUE was that we found that plants lose ammonia. A lot of this came from Shepherd's and Francis' work, where they found, you know, 70, 80 pounds of nitrogen lost through the leaves as ammonia. That these losses had not been identified before. We wanted to pick up on that. We early on collaborated with the Nebraska group. Obviously, I had Nebraska connections, and that worked quite well. And then plant and loss, also what was noticed both in wheat and corn was that the NH3 losses through the leaves increased as you increased in. So the inefficiency became more inefficient at some of the higher rates, especially in terms of NH3, and even worse when there was a moisture stress. So we flipped that around, and then, you know, the next question was, is that NUE, we knew what it was for cereal production in the world, and those numbers I think are quite good. I recently had a kind of a quiz from Lakesh Sharma, if you know Lakesh, and he wanted to know some added detail associated with assumptions that were embedded within that paper, and very quickly, I wrote another paper that was basically a defense of some of the assumptions that were embedded in that paper. But again, the flip side was, you know, what's if it's 33% in the world, what is it in sub-Saharan Africa, an area where clearly added help is needed? And it's 100. It's actually in excess of 100. How can you get, you know, more than 100% nitrogen use efficiency? And wrote a paper, and it's embarrassing. You know, you go to the last line, it says, high NUEs resulted of applying so little fertilizer nitrogen at the expense of mining an already depleted soil resource. So it's like, yeah, you divide by zero, it becomes infinity. But NUEs of 100% in Africa, and they're treading water. And so this is a sad statistic, but sometimes you have to kind of look at the alternative, especially if you're looking and using the difference method. So very early on, we were fortunate. The engineers asked us, you know, at what resolution should we be working at on the mechanical side? And I said, I don't know. I do not know. So we chose the lowest possible denominator. I was laughed at when I presented this data in Indianapolis. These guys, you know, they have lost it for sure in Stillwater, where we took soil samples from every square foot, and then we went back and took a soil sample from that square foot again to make sure that it wasn't sampling error. We destroyed the plots with all our sampling. But what we found was that there were significant differences, and these were homogeneous Bermuda grass pastures, significant differences, you know, 1, 2, 3 feet apart. And the error bars, you can see the error bars in some of the analysis in terms of whether or not it was the soil test P, and then that fertilizer recommendation would have gone from zero to the maximum amount 2, 3 feet away. But whether or not it was the Bermuda grass pasture data that you see in the bottom or a wheat field up on the top is that we feel that that resolution, if we're going to call it precision ag, needs to be a foot, 2 foot. And then I'll show you more that says it should be by plant in corn. Cornfield in Iowa, you can see that middle plant that frankly, as a function of time, is going to become a weed. And it will become a weed because of competition for moisture and or nutrients, and it is highly unlikely to produce a cob. And this is what some of the data looked like, where we went into several different transects. There's several that follow, where yields range from zero, obviously, all the way up to 20,000 kilograms per hectare when expressed on a biplant basis, and the area that each individual plant occupied, and that we painstakingly went in and measured and harvested. Same thing for some work in Shelton, Nebraska. Found the same kind of variability that was present. There's a lot of different sources that contribute to that, but the yield values, you know, is basically by cob. Huge differences in fields that looked on the surface to be homogeneous. So over all of these sites, Oklahoma, Iowa, Nebraska, Ohio, Mexico, Argentina, we basically found that the average plant-to-plant difference in yield was 44 bushels. So are we going to, you know, if we've got that big a difference, 40 bushel difference, and I know it up front, I think it has to be treated differently as well, especially if I can see it. So it was comprehensive. I know Shepherds was angry, but I basically made him sign off on it. And I'm bigger than he. That's for real, you know, and it wasn't just Oklahoma data. And I know we get over the years that somehow the data doesn't count because it was in Oklahoma, but it counts the same. So we immediately, because we worked with engineering, we wanted methods that we could interpret optimum N rates within each field. They put together a ramp system where I could go across starting high rates in the bottom of the screen and then going up to the high rates again as per the graph that you see on the right, that we could do these automatically. There's another ramp right behind it that we could put out in farmer's field, and that farmer could walk out to that field and say, well, where's the optimum N rate based on the differences that were in growth? This was really, really fun. And it was really fun to be able to go out there and see those. But the problem was is that you see the ramp that's just behind it? The same thing, the optimum N rate, we could not decipher. It changed within that field. And I can also say that the N rates that were put down within this ramp in terms of the engineering, we tested those as well, and they were spot on. So, you know, where was this variability coming from? Ramp calibration strips, you can see the NDVI data is in purple. The yield data is in blue. That, again, are these the kinds of things that I could see with NDVI early in the season and then project what those were out? I mean, obviously, you could. They were highly correlated. So another one that we looked on was in recognizing that the variability was that much smaller. Then we go back to engineering. We say, look, I need an applicator that puts down different rates in a stamp, so to speak, 9 meters squared. I want to go into each 9 meters squared and decipher what that optimum fertilizer nitrogen rate is going to be. And the map that you'll see there on the right is that we varied those rates. There were 4 checks within that square, and then I think it's 40, 60, 180 that were put out sequentially, and you can see that in that bottom slide in terms of the response. Then we also used a blue dye within the UAN so that we could actually see it and see those stamps. This apparatus. Farmers, we took this to a field day, were rather brutal. They laughed. They were not nice. But this was so important because what happened was we recognized that optimum end rate, I couldn't even decipher it within. I couldn't repeat that from 9 meter squares to 9 meter squares to 9 meter squares. There was such variability that was out there that this was incredibly revealing because I had an entire experiment every 3 meters. They were 3 by 3, so every 3 meters I'd go forward, 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 try and interpret that, and the optimum end rate changed. So on the research side, it basically led us back to that biplant. You know, what resolution should we be working on? And actually, we were at 4 square feet in winter wheat, and then later to biplant. So once we kind of felt like we had a handle on what resolution the engineers should work on, neither John or Marv was at all afraid of building an applicator that could treat the variability where we said, and we delivered from the agronomic side, where those differences existed. So on the theory side, one of the things that we did working in Iowa, Nebraska, Wisconsin, and also Oklahoma, is that we found that those RIs that we used, whether it was a ramp or these calibration stamps or just an enriched strip, was that there was no relationship between that response index and wheat grain yield. And that was important because what that said was I needed to have an independent estimate of the RI and an independent estimate of yield. If both impact fertilizer nitrogen demand, which we believe that they do, this was very telling. Another thing that we've done, and again, a product of the long-term experiments, some of our older students haven't seen, but basically what this looked at was, should I ever combine 2 consecutive years of data, even in a long-term trial? And the answer is no. There's heterogeneity of error variance that prohibit us, technically, as per the statisticians, from combining any 2 years within that trial, or any 2 sites for that matter. Heterogeneity of variance supposedly prevents us from combining those sites, yet, you know, some of our statisticians in Stillwater and elsewhere have recommended combining sites when, frankly, they can't and they shouldn't. A recent paper, it was just published this year, where we went in and looked at the optimum fertilizer end rates from published data, not OSU's data, but from corn trials that are surrounding, the I states. There's Kentucky, Missouri, Texas, a lot of different long-term experiments where those optimum end rates changed radically from trial to trial at all of these locations. And what's disconcerting is that in many of these locations, we're applying the same end rates year after year after year. And XSN that's in subsurface profiles, I think that has become a problem. Another thing that we did here recently was these long-term trials. They provide such a resource for us to kind of look at things differently. But they have to be long-term trials that are managed like that picture that Dr. Anall showed, that the aerial photograph that you can see, that we had reliable data that was out there. But the question here was, can I use the last 3 years or the last 5 years to predict what that yield's going to be in that ensuing year, or the yield goal concept or process? And so we just go in sequence. You can kind of see that. And just keep moving that down, copying it down in Excel. And Excel is a wonderful tool to kind of do things like this. What we found was that the average of the last 5 years and plus 20% using whether it's the Ream method from Minnesota, or I think there was some other work from South Dakota, is that you cannot. That yield goal just doesn't work. We would like to use the yield goal, but the data clearly says that there is no relationship, whether or not it's 5 years or 3 years, take your pick. And this we will be publishing soon. So as an added one, understanding that yield goals just don't work, and what we have to recognize is that yield goals, people say, well, they're no longer used. It's not true. I mean, that is precisely what people are doing and thinking that it's going to work, but we need to lead them away from that. In work at Mexico with the Yvonne Ortiz Monasterio, is that we learned that even if there was severe stress early, so long as I had a homogenous stand, I could recuperate 100% of that yield. And that graph on the left side that you see is that that check plot, which is basically that pink diamond, that if I fertilized it, look at all of those others excluding the pink diamond, these were top dress applications made to homogenous stands. In Ciudad Obregón, they have these homogenous stands because a lot of this is flood irrigated. They can get quick water to that system, get perfect stands, and then go back in and apply the fertilizer in later. But what we learned from this was that if those CVs are low, we could recuperate yield. If the CVs were high, we could not. And so this was an algorithm that many of you have seen where we use both the yield potential and that response index. But the important part is at the bottom where we embedded CV within that decision-making process. So it wasn't just the NDVI. It was the CV that basically defined what that response to fertilizer nitrogen could be so long as it was low. If it was high, it basically sent that fertilizer N rate down. And just a graph and basically some sensitivity analysis that we did on the bottom right that kind of showed how important that was to embed the CV within that process. The top left is basically, you know, CV in some of these populations that those NDVI values come from a normal population, and that was important. But the middle right, CV was independent of scale, is also important. If my measurements are being taken by acre and I'm going to use the CV over that acre, it's perfectly fine. But then that CV encumbers nitrogen rate risk that, again, remains important within that component. Some of you have seen this as well, and it's like, you know, what have they done that's new? I'm tired of listening to this bald guy already. Well, I'm not done. This work was fun because on the corn, we recognized that we had to work by plant. You guys, we've shown you some of those responses in the by plant and the yield. But this asks the question of what could I do so that I could better see that plant. We were interested in being able to see it with the green seeker sensor. It wasn't necessarily that we wanted to do the leaf orientation work to increase yields. I mean, yes, we're always looking for that, but we wanted to be able to see each plant. So various seed orientations, various seed placements is that very quickly we learned that absolutely you could. Absolutely you could design a planter. We also have a patent on a planter that Randy Taylor put together that we can orient the seed so that those leaves come up perfectly perpendicular left and right every single time. But you have to orient it. So it has a cool patent in terms of delivering that. And we also got a yield bump, but we really just wanted to see those plants. With the Green Seeker sensor, you can because it's a very narrow bandwidth and it's a very narrow field of view. yet wide. So you could go over each individual plant, capture some of that information, and then capture NDVI and CV data at the same time, and also by plant. So synthesis in terms of what we were able to do is that recognizing the independence of yield potential and RI, we recognize that the demand for fertilizer nitrogen changes every single year, as do the optimum N rates. And that was critical, is that those N rates need to be changing every year. And the importance and impact of environment on those nitrogen decisions change radically from year to year. And we need to respect that environment and its impact on that demand. So static N recommendations are not doing any of us any good. Oklahoma's no better than any, where we have farmers that are putting out the same N rate every year, as much as we discourage it. But one of the beautiful things, I think Dr. Anall has had some incredible success. I think probably 1 million acres that he has this year under the Enrich Drip program, and he's making them money and saving us from a lot of potential problems later environmentally in terms of contamination. We have developed 32 algorithms that are on that website, so they're being used in Colombia, Mexico. Yvonne Ortiz Monasterio, who's present tonight, we'll tailor them to whatever language, to whatever system, to whatever yield levels that they are at. And they are easily done. And so Newell Kitchen, Jim Shepherds, Kyle Holland, Dave Franz, and myself published a paper on the merit and value of several algorithms that are out there that people have a change and can make those decisions mid-season. But making those decisions mid-season is important. So, surprise that this is where we ended up. That question of resolution, you know, getting the order right, being able to predict yield, being able to get an in-season estimate of what that nitrogen fertilizer was supposed to be, using the CV data that was present, and then an algorithm for nitrogen that, again, is functional. This applicator did all of that. This applicator did all of that in 2010. Marv Stone died last year, and what a huge loss in the homecoming accident that we endured in Stillwater. But this applicator did everything that's on that graph. Why has it not taken off? It's cost prohibitive. $3.50 corn, who's going to invest in this? You know, and we understand that. But it doesn't change the fact that this is what is needed if we're going to truly address the issue of improved nitrogen use efficiency in corn and or wheat. And again, this one worked by plant. So, smaller items. The bottom picture, I asked Marv, that I really felt that we needed to have something that was usable by smaller scale producers and in the third world. Those sensors that you see in the front, Jared Crane is actually using them. Marv built on his benchtop. Trimble very quickly picked up on that technology, and this is a handheld sensor that is sold commercially today. And in the picture is Bill Gates. He's holding one of our handheld sensors. So I'm going to submit that for my Pulitzer. And then the last thing I'm going to talk about, and I don't want to go too long, is that the hand planter. These are the landscapes of Central America where maize is produced. And you can see that severe erosion takes place. CSA News was kind to cover some of this work. This is another slide you've seen of hand planting in Central America. Chemically treated seed that he's handling by hand. And then I can tell you I almost fell over when I took this picture. But the hand planter that's been developed, Randy Taylor, Wayne Kiner, several have helped us. This is a woman in Lira, Uganda, that's using one of our hand planners. This is a heavier version of what we have kind of re-engineered here recently that works. And one of the benefits of that hand planner is getting that chemically treated seed out of the hands of producers, especially the women that might be carrying a child, and the toxicity effects, minor ones that impact the health of that child that they might carry. And the women are doing a lot of the planning. And we need to put in their hands a tool that is safe. And then the other one that's big for us is that I can deliver homogeneity of plant stands 7 inches apart. For every strike that I release on that planter, I get one seed that's laid down. That one seed's important because he's thrown down 2 or 3 seeds. So it's both efficient, both increases yields, and then sustainable in terms of what might be out there. It's in terms of health, excuse me. So one of the neat things as I thought about, you know, what I would bring tonight that was different or new or a contribution, I have thought about this a lot, is that for both the developed and developing world, the precision agriculture for maize needs to be by plant. I'm sorry. You know, I know some people, I hate this guy. He's wanting to tell me how to work by plant. I don't care. We got to tell, on the research side, the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, not pieces of the truth. And the same thing goes for, we can use that hand planter for urea. So Cydrus applications of urea, getting them right next to that plant. Some of the cool work that Sheppers and Hodgen did at Nebraska was that I can get it close to that plant, I can improve that efficiency. This is their precision nitrogen applicator. He's putting down fertilizer in the middle of the season anyway, but putting it down precisely and getting it below the surface of the soil, especially with urea in terms of the ammonia losses, is and remains important. I just want to cover some of the guys that I've worked with that, you know, makes you sad, but Phillips, Thomason, there's a skinny Dr. Freeman, Brenda, Olga Chung, Dr. Kitchen, Dr. Mullen, a lot of them are here tonight. Peter O'Mara and Lawrence Ala, two of our MS graduates that are working on the hand planter in Uganda as we speak. Randy Taylor, for those of you that don't know him, is in charge of a lot of our engineering. B. Kim is here tonight. She's one of Wade Thomason's PhD graduates. Dr. Westerman, another skinny Dr. Freeman up there. Jeff Vest, this has been fun. Matthew Reynolds at CIMMYT, B. Kim and Yumiko Konki, Brian, Giles Randall, Kefi Lou Desta, really wonderful people. John Shanahan, I think, is here. Eric Miller, Jeremiah Mullock, the Mayfields. Yvonne has just been special. We've sent, I think, 110 of our graduate students to Mexico, to CIMMYT, and they worked with him 1 week, 2 week projects, giving them, especially the American kids, giving them that international experience that they haven't had, and Matthew Rourke and some of the data analysis over time. John Lamb, my office together, another Pulitzer Prize photo with Dr. Borlaug explaining out in the field how the Green Seeker sensor worked. I haven't seen Antonio, but Sheppers, Marv, and John, what a gift it's been for me to work with some really, really good people. So as I kind of distill down what I've done and my career, 6 really fun years with CIMMYT in Mexico and Guatemala. I was with Dr. Borlaug the day he died in Dallas. A lot of people attribute him to saying some other rather bizarre things. I don't know. He said them to me, but if he said anything, he grabbed a hold of my hand and he kind of, guy had some energy and some strength that you have no idea. And it was like, you know, if he said anything at all, he said, get to work. Get to work. You know enough already. He didn't say any of the other things. Anyway, get to work. And I believe that. But I have colleagues I never could have dreamed of having. I have loved every single day of working in this field. I absolutely love what I do. And the last thing, and the last slide, and I'm done. But for the younger guys that are here, if you can put together that web page as soon as absolutely possible, the pictures. I get calls on the phone, and this website really helps me because, okay, can you go to my website? You just type in nitrogen use efficiency on Google. It'll come up first. Not a problem. And I can take them immediately to the pictures that I need to show them to communicate my point. But this is like a notebook. It's a notebook, organized, disorganized. A lot of guys tell me, I hate your webpage. But if they call me on the phone, I can take them where I want because I can communicate that. So again, I would encourage that. All of the algorithms are on there as well. And with that, thank you again, Carrie. Thank you, Josh, for the opportunity. Thank you.